Hello and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, August 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. He's living a life of redemption. Second Chance reopens with new manager. Thrift store had been closed since March due to COVID. When the Second Chance thrift store, 17 North 11th Street, reopened to the public on Monday, it was symbolic in a sense for Brandon Trimble, who has been given another chance to find peace and purpose in his life. In March 2019, Trimble crashed his car into a Fort Dodge exit sign as he drove along U.S. Highway 20. Trimble had been under the influence of alcohol in what he described as blackout drunk. The exit sign crushed the front windshield of the car, recalled Trimble, who was then pursued by police as he continued driving to the Days Inn by Wyndham, Fort Dodge. I was arrested before I got to the hotel room where I was staying. Alcoholism has been a lifelong problem for Trimble, who said he's lost cars, homes, and relationships through the years because of it. But this time was going to be different for Trimble. He remembered while sitting in jail that the Beacon of Hope Men's Shelter was a place he could turn to. He had visited there before in 2017. I was homeless. I was beat up. The mental toll of everything was still sitting on my head, Trimble said. The thing I remembered from 2017, it was a safe place I could come to. The people I dealt with in 2017, they did whatever they could to help me out. They are very adamant about encouraging growth. That night, all I could think about, I had no idea what time it was in jail, that when I get out, I'm going to Beacon. And he did. He met Steve Rowe, executive director of the Beacon, at the thrift store after filling out an application at the shelter. Meanwhile, all of Trimble's belongings were still back at the hotel. I really started to explain the situation with the hotel room, Trimble said. My wrecked car was sitting in the parking lot of the hotel, and I still had a bottle unopened. I told Steve if I walk from here to that hotel, there's a good chance I'm going to drink it, and Steve said, no. Someone walked over there, they got rid of the bottle, there was a mess over there, I had puked in the sink and it was clogged. That was a picture of what my life was like at the time. After the mess was cleaned and Trimble had a chance to settle in back at the Beacon, Rowe prayed for him. It's been about a year and a half since the crash, and Trimble, now 38, has kept his sobriety since. When the thrift store reopened, it was with Trimble as the store's manager. The store had been closed for more than 5 months due to the COVID-19 pandemic. As of yesterday, I'm the store manager here, Trimble said on Tuesday. Sales from the thrift store directly benefit the men's shelter. Rowe said God opened the door for Trimble to be in the manager position. He's living a life of redemption, Rowe said. Trimble starts his day at the store sorting donations with a group of men from the shelter at 8:30 a.m. We get clothing hung up on racks, Trimble said. Any other donations, we sort through those and get those into carts. A lot of it is cleanup, too, from the mess we make. For the most part, we have anywhere from 5 to 15 guys over here in the morning. For some, it's therapy. Others don't want to be here. Trimble is also responsible for making sure items are priced correctly and is responsible for the cash register. The work has been more rewarding than Trimble thought it would be. This line of work I've never been in, Trimble said. I honestly didn't think when I started here that I would stay here. In the very beginning, that curiosity is what kept me here. My plan was to save some money, pay some fines. What stuck to me very heavily when Steve said it in morning chapel, you can go get a job, but can you keep that job? Well, that hit home with me because I've had several good jobs and pissed them all away. Trimble has worked for Chantlin County in Humboldt, Overhead Door Company of Webster County, Certified Transmission, and Nestle Purina Pet Care. He came to Fort Dodge in 2012 to seek treatment from Community and Family Resources. Trimble struggled to maintain sobriety throughout the next several years. And although he stayed the course in terms of sobriety over the past year and a half, Trimble said the thought of having a drink hasn't left him. If it were up to me and I could handle it responsibly, I'd still be drinking, he said. I've managed to stay away from a drink or a drug. I've been able to walk away and say no. Before, I'd say no, but later that night I'd have one. Trimble never intended to stay at the Beacon as long as he has, but the process has been healing. At some point, I want to move from there, but I'm not ready for that yet, Trimble said. Anything I've done, whether good, bad, indifferent, I take responsibility for it. I don't ever want to return to the life I had. It's no fun living in cars, couch surfing, being in hospitals because I drank too much. Roe, along with Chaplain Eric Howard and the men, have helped Trimble find faith. You have to have a higher power, a faith in something, said Trimble. Between him and Eric, they are a godsend. Eric has been able to explain the Bible to me in ways I can understand it. The calmness that comes from him. I have a peace going on inside me. Roe has been pleased with Trimble's efforts and progress. When a person changes his life and starts living a new life, that's what God does, Roe said. He promotes, and Brandon deserves everything he gets right now. Someday, Trimble may be ready to leave. They aren't trying to keep me from doing what I want to do, but that I need to keep being me when I leave the shelter, Trimble said. The Second Chance thrift store is asking that most customers wear masks unless a medical condition prevents them from doing so. We are asking people to wear masks because our men do work over here, Roe said. People say, well, Target and Aldi don't require you to wear a mask. If you have an employee get sick at Target, they get told to go home and come back. If one of our guys gets sick, they are at the Beacon where they are around other people. We can't isolate someone at the Beacon. We are taking the precaution of asking people to wear masks. If they do come in and have a medical issue or a reason they can't wear a mask, all they have to do is say they can't wear one. We trust people will be honest about that. We are just trying to protect our employees and the men from the Beacon of Hope. In addition to clothing items, the thrift store sells art, furniture, and jewelry. The store is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Humboldt CSD prepares to return to the classroom. First day of school is Wednesday. As the 14-day positivity rate of COVID-19 decreases for Humboldt County, school officials prepare for the start of the school year next week. The Humboldt Community School District is working closely with Humboldt County Memorial Hospital and Humboldt County Public Health to monitor the number of active cases and the positivity rate in the county, HCSD Superintendent Jim Murray said. Earlier in the week, the state of Iowa's coronavirus monitoring website had Humboldt County listed with a positivity rate of more than 22%. After some results reporting issues were resolved, the rate decreased to 8.9% on Wednesday. The two main factors that Murray said will influence the district's decision to go from in-person instruction to remote learning or a hybrid of the two are the county's positivity rate and the rate of student absenteeism, which it won't know until school starts. Families who don't feel comfortable sending their children to school during the COVID-19 pandemic can choose to use the district's remote learning option, the superintendent said. Before the first day of school on Wednesday, HCSD will host orientation and conferences for all grades on Monday and Tuesday. Typically, only elementary school students would have conferences before the start of school, but this year the district felt it was important to ease kids back to school, Murray said. We were really concerned about the social, emotional health of our students since we had such an abrupt end to last year, and we have a number of students who have never had those orientations for changing buildings or changing levels, he said. Overall, Humboldt will be using the typical mitigation strategies to try to avoid the spread of COVID-19, Murray said. We're going to do social distancing as very best as we can, to follow those recommended guidelines, he said. And where we can't, we're going to require masks or face shields. The district will be providing each student with a mask and a face shield, he added. More hand washing stations have been added to the middle school and the high school. In general, the district will be trying to limit the number of students in a cohort and staggering things like lunch, recess, and other class movements to limit the number of students passing in the hallways. Murray said the district will try its best to have physical education classes outside whenever possible, and for students going to recess, requiring hand washing and sanitizing before and after recess. What Murray is worried about more than absent students is actually having enough staff. I think our challenge won't be the positivity rate and hopefully not student absenteeism. It will be with staff, he said. Do we have enough bus drivers, food service workers, custodians, associate staff? Those are the people who truly hold us up. We lack substitutes in all those areas. He said that if a time comes where the district doesn't have enough healthy staff available, it may have to move to the hybrid model of learning, with students attending in-person classes part-time and participating in remote learning part-time. We're all hands on deck, and if the superintendent needs to go down and help with something, I'll certainly be first in line, he said. Murray said the Humboldt County Memorial Hospital and Humboldt County Public Health have been essential and outstanding partners in helping the district make decisions for the best interests of its families. Youth Empowerment organizes virtual fishing tournament. Fishing can be anywhere in North America through next May. The Youth Empowerment Association is encouraging youth to find their favorite fishing spot and reel in a big one. The YEA has started a virtual fishing tournament. Fish anywhere in North America, record the catch with video, pictures, and details of length, location of catch, date, and time. A leaderboard has been established on YEA's Facebook page. The tournament, which will run through May 31, 2021, is free to participate in. There are over 800 species available. The YEA will only be counting the most common 50. The objective is to catch the largest fish in length in each species category. Leader in each category gets 1 point. With counting 50 species, 50 points total are available. Fishing can be anywhere in North America, and 95% of the fish on the list can be caught in Iowa. Fish need to be photographed next to a standard tape measure. Upload to the page and date. Results will be updated weekly to see who is leading in each category. Prizes are awarded in each category. Winners will be determined at midnight on May 31st. Must be present at YEA's next fishing tournament in Webster County on June 5th, 2021 to be awarded. Whoever ends with the most points will be awarded the Jim Buckley Virtual Master Angler Award Trophy. Webster County adds 65 COVID-19 cases. Another 65 COVID-19 infections have been reported to Webster County Public Health since last week, bringing the county's total number of cases over 900. Of 912 cases, 75 are currently active, 60 of which are in the county at large, and 15 of which are in the Fort Dodge Correctional Facility. In total, 361, or 40%, of cases have come from the prison. Webster County had 608 cases on July 23rd, just shy of a month ago. The county's cases fall into the following age categories. Children ages 0 to 17, 41. Adults ages 18 to 40, 453. Middle-aged adults ages 41 to 60, 284. Older adults ages 61 to 80, 118. Elderly adults age 81 plus, 16. Age categories with the highest increase in infections since July 23rd are older adults, which went from 71 to 118, a 66% increase, and middle-aged adults, which went from 180 to 284, or a 58% increase. The adult category experienced a 42% increase. Disease investigations continue to show that positive cases are coming from close contact gatherings and families, said Kelly Bloomquist, Public Information Officer for Webster County Public Health. WCPH continues to ask the public to refrain from close contact with those they are not co-exposed to or typically around. If you're not sure of others' exposure risks, wear a mask, Bloomquist advised. If social distancing isn't possible, wear a mask. Wednesday's report came as Iowa surpassed 1,000 deaths. CHC working with IDPH to ensure accurate reporting. Community Health Center of Fort Dodge said on Wednesday that it was the community clinic that the Iowa Department of Public Health and Webster County Public Health had been working with this week to resolve some COVID-19 testing issues. On Monday, the WCPH released a statement that antigen test results from one local clinic were coded as polymerase chain reaction or viral test results in the Iowa Disease Surveillance System. The department also said there were approximately 3,000 negative test results from the clinic that had been delayed in being reported to the IDSS. With the correction of the errors and the submission of the delayed negative test results over the past few days, the county's 14-day positivity rate has decreased from about 23% on Friday to 2% on Wednesday. The reporting process, like all other aspects pertaining to COVID-19, is more complex than what is visible at the surface level, CHC said in a statement released on Wednesday afternoon. The release continued, adding that all results, both positive and negative, have been reported to the IDPH on a daily basis. Due to the high volume of test results being reported, the system was overwhelmed, CHC explained. All positive test results from CHC are submitted directly to the IDPH system so that contact tracing can begin immediately. All negative test results were faxed to IDPH for manual input, CHC said. We are working with the IDPH in good faith to ensure all results are reported accurately, CHC said. An editorial. Money woes slow down Postal Service. Agency leaders must use all the funding at their disposal. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. So goes the United States Postal Service's motto. No one said anything about lack of funding. Despite his denials, President Donald Trump is being accused by some of withholding funds available to the USPS, allegedly in order to limit the agency's ability to handle tens of millions of mailed-in ballots for the November 3rd election. If indeed anyone is failing to use resources available to the Postal Service, changes are in order. Billions of dollars in emergency funding linked to the coronavirus epidemic are available already. USPS officials should be using them. In addition, House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, has suggested another emergency appropriation of $25 billion for the Postal Service. It is doubtful the agency needs that much to cope with COVID-19 or the November election, but if some additional money is needed, it should be provided by lawmakers. But neither COVID-19 nor politics is at the heart of the Postal Service's money crisis. It existed long before the pandemic. It will persist long after the virus, this one at least, has been controlled. Legacy costs are the albatross around the Postal Service's neck. That translates to enormous pension liabilities built up over years with no way of dealing with them except for demanding a taxpayer bailout. Somehow, that challenge must be addressed. How? The possibilities are limited and they all trace back to either taxpayers or USPS customers, the same people. For now, however, the issue is whether the Postal Service is using all the money at its disposal to ensure that the mail is delivered efficiently. If that is not happening, whatever the reason may be, heads should roll. Youthful Dodgers ready to hit the links. The Fort Dodge Boys Golf Program is in a period of transition as the Dodgers prepare to start the 2020 campaign on Thursday, the home duel against Ankeny Centennial. Only three letter winners are back for head coach Mike Maracle's squad, which saw the majority of its varsity lineup from a year ago graduate. Senior Caleb Anderson and juniors Andrew Allstott and Peyton Hayes return with significant varsity experience and will help bridge the gap as the team looks to replace 2019 regulars Isaac Haig, Gavin Strain, Mason Bowman, and Nolan Daniel. Sophomores Aaron Amhoff, Carson Werning, and Curtis Bickford join Allstott, Anderson, and Hayes as the six who will be on the tee for Miracle versus the Jaguars at the Fort Dodge Country Club. We're a pretty young group overall, with Caleb being our only senior, Miracle said. We'll obviously lean on Caleb and Andrew quite a bit. Caleb is just a steady, competitive kid who has won an individual state bowling championship. He knows what it takes mentally to succeed at this level, both because of his nature and his experience on the golf course. Andrew put in a ton of work this past off season. He's ready to take a big step forward on the course, and maturity-wise as an upperclassman who could be a real leader in our program. Hayes, Bickford, and junior Aiden Porter all logged varsity holes a year ago as well. Allstott has solidified the Dodgers' lead varsity position through qualifying, followed by Anderson, Amhoff, Werning, Hayes, and Bickford. We lack overall tournament experience, especially given who we're going to be going up against in the CIML and at the 4A level, Maracle said. not just in high school meets, but I'd really like to see the boys entered in more junior events during the summer months. Competitive golf is a whole different ballgame. You have to be much more mentally sharp than if you're out casually playing with your friends. We're not quite there yet, but the focus, as always, will be on improving every day. Miracle is also emphasizing the importance of having a short-term memory on the course. I see a lot of potential in many of our boys, but they can't let a bad shot or a bad hole snowball, Miracle said. They can't stew about it and have it ruin their round. That's a big hurdle to clear. And, of course, the short game is so important. Cutting down on extra strokes around the greens, both with chipping and putting, is going to be critical, whether we're talking about the first guy on varsity or the last in JV. It's an important lesson for all of them. The annual Phil Jocelyn FDSH Invitational is September 1st at the FDCC. Miracle will be assisted by David Luke. The 2020 Fort Dodge Boys Golf roster is as follows. Senior, Caleb Anderson. Juniors, Andrew Allstott, Peyton Hayes, Aiden Porter, Carson Kaler, Alex Dorn, Jordan Lemon, Aiden Highstand. Sophomores, Aaron Amhoff, Carson Werning, Curtis Bickford, Cord Utley, Gray Westerhoff, Michael Miller, Nathan Beekman, and Fisher Novencito. Freshmen, Evan Pratt, Lawson O'Brown, Josiah Riedel, Zach Siebrecht, and Brandon Ward. The schedule is as follows. August 20th, Ankeny Centennial, 9 a.m. August 24th, at Mason City Invitational, 10 a.m. August 26th, at Ankeny, 2:30 p.m. September 1st, Jocelyn FDSH Invitational, 10 a.m. September 9th, at Ankeny Invitational, 9 a.m. September 14th, at Ames Invitational, 10 a.m. September 17th, Ames, 9 a.m. September 18th, at Marshalltown Invitational, 10 a.m. September 21st, at Indianola Invitational, 10 a.m. September 24th, Marshalltown at 3:30 p.m. September 28th, at Mason City, 3:30 p.m. And September 29th, at CIML Iowa Conference Invitational in Mason City, 10 a.m. Ex-Dodger Clayton headed to Bethany College. Malcolm Clayton will take his talents to Bethany College in the fall. Clayton, a former All-Stater at Fort Dodge Senior High, spent the last two seasons at Iowa Lakes. With the Lakers, Clayton averaged almost 12 points, over 4 rebounds, and nearly 3 assists per game, helping them finish 26-6 overall and 13-3 in the ICCAC. He was named to the conference honorable mention squad. "I'm super excited," Clayton said. "Iowa Lakes helped me tremendously. The coaching staff there really helped me step my game up and play at a college pace. Everything I felt like I lacked when I first went there, I improved on and gained better skills. They did a great job helping me grow on the court and as a man." As a freshman for the Lakers, Clayton posted over 7 points per game with 3.6 rebounds and 2.2 assists. He finished his two-year career with 613 points, 261 rebounds, 155 assists, 46 steals, and 20 blocks. Clayton has big plans for his final seasons at Bethany and will be joined by his brother, Solomon. The two previously played together at Fort Dodge and Iowa Lakes. "I still haven't got a ring yet, so that's what I'm chasing," he said. "At the end of all of this, I want to be a champion. I've never experienced that in high school or college, and several teams I've been on have had the talent but just fell short. I'm excited to show off what I've got at the next level and to chase after a ring for 2 more years." Bethany is an NAIA school based in Lindsborg, Kansas. They are coached by Dan O'Dowd and went 9-19 overall last year. "I picked Bethany because I felt very confident in the program and the coach," Clayton said. "When the head coach talked to me, it seemed like he runs a good and winning program. The school also offered Solomon, so it was just a good fit." A 2018 graduate of FDSH, Clayton finished his career by averaging over 17 points per game as a senior. He is 3rd on the school's all-time scoring charts with 1,074 points. Schedule released for Tritons in 2021. The schedule is set for the Iowa Central football team and the rest of the ICCAC this coming spring. with the NJACAA making the decision to push football from the fall to March 2021, the Tritons were forced to rework their schedule. Iowa Central's first game is now set for Saturday, March 27th, at Dodger Stadium against Southern Shreveport. The Tritons will play 4 home games, 4 road games, and have a bye through the end of May. After taking on Southern Shreveport for the first time, Iowa Central will host longtime rival Iowa Western on Saturday, April 3rd. 3 consecutive road games follow as the Tritons head to College of DuPage, played at Ellsworth, and are at Iowa Western to conclude April. Following a bye, Iowa Central returns home on Saturday, May 8th, to host Snow with Ellsworth the next week. They conclude the season on Saturday, May 22nd, at Arkansas Baptist. The 3 ICCAC teams will be playing home and away games against each other. Teams can begin practice on March 1st. NJCAA officials limited the season to 8 games for all programs. Iowa Central went 7-6 a year ago, capturing its second consecutive Graphic Edge Bowl with a 31-28 victory over Nashua. The Tritons also won the conference title, beating both Iowa Western 28-26 and Ellsworth 51-6. They also played both DuPage and Snow a year ago, going 1-1 in those games. The Iowa Central 2021 spring football schedule is as follows. March 27th, Southern Shreveport. April 3rd, Iowa Western. April 10th, at College of DuPage. April 17th, at Ellsworth. April 24th, at Iowa Western. May 9th, Snow. May 15th, Ellsworth. And May 22nd, at Arkansas Baptist. News brief. Iowa man illegally transports bear hides, gets probation. A federal magistrate judge in North Dakota has sentenced an Iowa man to a year of probation for unlawfully bringing 2 black bear hides into the United States from Canada. Manitoba licensing laws prohibit more than 1 big game license of the same type in the same hunting year. Prosecutors say when Lewis Flodden Jr. was initially questioned by customs officials, he said he only shot 1 bear and the other belonged to another hunter at the same camp. Flodden, 69, of Pella, later admitted he shot the second bear and knew it was illegal. Authorities say both bears were also killed outside of the designated hunting area allowed by Flodden's license. He agreed to forfeit the hides that he brought through the Pembina port of entry in North Dakota. Magistrate Judge Alice Seneschal also fined Flodden $7,500 Tuesday after he pleaded guilty to unlawful transport of wildlife in foreign commerce. Game hunting laws play an essential role in ensuring proper wildlife management, said U.S. Attorney Drew Wrigley. We strictly enforce these provisions as a component of our environmental stewardship obligations. News brief. Drake removes 14 students for violating virus guidelines. Drake University has removed more than a dozen students from its Des Moines campus, saying they violated coronavirus safety and prevention guidelines at gatherings both on and off campus. Drake University Dean of Students, Jerry Parker, said 14 students were asked to leave campus for 2 weeks, television station KCCI reported. I want to be crystal clear. We are serious and we will not hesitate to take the necessary actions to mitigate the potential spread of COVID-19, Parker said in a written statement. The private school asks undergraduate students to sign a compact in which they agree to social distance, self-monitor for symptoms, and wear face coverings in campus buildings. The compact states that students will be disciplined if they host or attend parties on or off campus. Students who repeatedly violate the compact could be suspended or expelled. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, August 20th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Alfred Klingson. Alfred Dwayne Klingson, 87, passed away Tuesday, August 18th, at his home. Funeral services will be 3 p.m. Friday, August 21st, at Our Savior's Lutheran Church and Calendar, with Pastor Greg Stano and Pastor Deb Stano officiating. Private family graveside service will be at the Danish Lutheran Cemetery west of Callander, with military rites by American Legion Peterson Post number 431 of Gowrie. Visitation will be after 1:30 p.m. Friday, August 21st, at the church until service time. Alfred is survived by his four sons, Kevin Klingson and spouse Marcia of Fort Dodge, Gary Klingson and spouse Lori of Gledville, Minnesota, Scott Klingson and spouse Patrice, and Mark Klingson and spouse Kim, all of Gowrie. 10 grandchildren, Tyler, Luke, Jenna, Jordan, Logan, John, Justin, Colton, Connor, and Caitlin. 3 great-grandchildren, Presley, Shay, and Clay, and special companion, Margaret Woodruff. He was preceded in death by his wife, Artis. Parents, Lewis and Thora Johnson Klingson. Sisters, Alice Slotten, LaVon Bowers, and Doris Danielson. And brothers, Laverne and Donald Klingson. Alfred Dewayne Klingson was born September 26, 1932, at Slifer. He was baptized and confirmed at the Danish Lutheran Church. He attended Summers High School and started working at Tobin's from 1950 to 1952. Alfred served in the United States Army during the Korean conflict and was honorably discharged in 1954. He was united in marriage to Artis Dewey on June 19, 1955, and 4 sons were born to this union. They established their home in Slifer, where he farmed until 1968, when they moved to a farm west of Callander, where he lived until his death. Alfred was a deacon, usher, greeter at his church. He belonged to American Legion Post number 592 of Callander. He farmed all his life, shelled corn, worked for Automatic Service Center, and later Certified Transmission, delivering transmissions. Alfred was well known for his corn shelling with his 4 sons. He enjoyed being with his grandchildren and attending all their sporting events. He also enjoyed wintering in Texas and making many friends. He will be deeply missed by all. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Karen M. Kearns. Karen M. Kearns, age 81, of Omaha, formerly of Rolfe, passed away Monday, August 17th, in Omaha, Nebraska. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 22nd, at the Faith Community Church near Palmer, with Reverend Russell Weller officiating. Burial will be at Clinton Garfield Cemetery near Rolfe. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, August 22nd, at the Faith Community Church near Palmer. For online condolences and obituary, visit powersfh.net. Jonathan Gitz. Jonathan T. Gitz, 29, of Fort Dodge, passed away Sunday, August 16th, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Services were August 19th. Expressions of sympathy may be directed through maurjohnsonfh.com, and that's spelled M-A-U-E-R Johnson F-H. Democratic Boundary Breakers Night, Obama, Clinton, Harris. The Democrats' historic boundary breakers joined forces Wednesday night at the party's national convention, pleading urgently for Joe Biden's diverse coalition to make whatever effort it takes to vote this fall rather than just complain about President Donald Trump. Their overriding message? Your lives and democracy itself may be at stake. Barack Obama, the nation's first black president, and Hillary Clinton, the first woman nominated for president by a major party, were speaking on Biden's behalf. And Kamala Harris, Biden's running mate and the first black woman on a major party ticket, was delivering highly anticipated remarks that will serve as her first introduction to millions of voters. Harris, a 55-year-old California senator, made a surprise appearance early in the program's opening moments. She called on Biden's supporters to have a specific voting plan to overcome the obstacles to voting raised by the coronavirus pandemic and postal slowdowns. When we vote, things change. When we vote, things get better. When we vote, we address the need for all people to be treated with dignity and respect, Harris said. So each of us needs a plan, a voting plan. Harris was to deliver her full remarks later in the night, following Obama in a political handoff that could help shape the next generation of Democratic politics. American democracy might not survive another 4 years of Trump, Obama warned in excerpts released in advance. He urges voters to embrace your own responsibility as citizens to make sure that the basic tenets of our democracy endure, because that's what is at stake right now, our democracy. In remarks remarkable for their dismissiveness of a U.S. president by his predecessor, Obama declares, Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job because he can't. Just 76 days before the election, Biden faces the difficult task of energizing each of the disparate factions that make up the modern-day Democratic Party, a coalition that spans generation, race, and ideology. And this fall, voters must deal with concerns over the COVID-19 pandemic that has created health risks for those who want to vote in person. Biden leads many polls, but his supporters report being motivated far more by antipathy toward Trump than genuine excitement about Biden, a 77-year-old white man who has spent nearly half a century in politics. Democrats hope that Harris and Obama in particular can help bridge the divide between those reassured by Biden's establishment credentials and those craving bolder change. An editorial from Leah Glasgow, who is the president and chief executive officer of Unity Point Health, Fort Dodge. Unity Point Health introduces new plans, partnerships. While many of us never imagined we'd be battling a global pandemic and recovering from a derecho in August 2020, here we are pushing forward. I am beyond thankful and proud of the Unity Point Health Fort Dodge team and community of Fort Dodge. I am inspired by our team's strength to provide the utmost care for our patients while juggling life's many different situations during this pandemic. We have become experts in shifting and adapting for our patients to provide the best outcome every patient, every time. In the midst of all the challenges of COVID-19, Unity Point Health Fort Dodge has recently moved forward on some exciting partnerships and services that will greatly benefit our community. I'm excited to share the following updates. In August, pediatric hospitalists from Blank Children's Hospital began providing on-site coverage at Trinity Regional Medical Center for inpatient pediatrics and newborn nursery. Pediatric hospitalists are now available and will help keep patients local. In addition, Unity Point Clinic Pediatrics continues to partner with Blank Children's Hospital to provide outreach clinics in Fort Dodge for endocrinology, neurology, and pulmonology. We are proud to announce our new East Side location for Unity Point Clinic Express. The new location will be in the new mall development area, Corridor Plaza. This prime location will be at the corner of First Avenue South and South 29th Street. The project team is excited to get construction underway as well as to flip our current walk-in clinic to this convenient express model of service. Unity Point Clinic Orthopedics welcomed orthopedic surgeon Dr. Anand in June, and now we officially have full-time orthopedic coverage back in Fort Dodge. Dr. Anand has hit the ground running and is doing both inpatient and outpatient surgical cases. Berry Hill Center launched a mobile crisis response team on July 1st. The mobile crisis response team provides on-site, face-to-face mental health services for an individual or family experiencing a mental health crisis. The team of professionals can respond wherever the crisis is occurring in our geographical area, in an individual's home, the community, or other locations where an individual lives, works, attends school, or socializes. Within 24 hours of completion of the crisis assessment, a case manager will place a phone call to follow up with the individual. Behavioral health urgent care at Berry Hill Center is now open Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., located on the lower east entrance of the building. The new behavioral health urgent care clinic provides services to individuals who are needing mental health services, psychiatric evaluation and assessment, addiction medicine, crisis services, and community resources. No referral or appointment is needed. Both pediatric and adult patients are welcomed. And we will soon be announcing a new service line coming to Fort Dodge in the coming weeks. Stay tuned. As we move forward with these initiatives and battle COVID-19, we cannot express how thankful we are for our community's support and everyone who has stepped up to help us. Together, we'll get through these crazy times. As we still see COVID in our community and hospital, it's important we all do what we can to prevent illness during this pandemic. Get the flu shot, mask up in public settings, wash your hands often, and practice social distancing. Doing these things will help our community stay healthy. Iowa tries to fix data error that backdated COVID-19 results. Iowa tried to correct a major flaw in its coronavirus data Wednesday that backdated thousands of positive and negative test results and distorted local infection rates across the state, a spokesman for Governor Kim Reynolds said. The announcement comes as school districts and parents have been relying on the data to make agonizing decisions over whether children should start the year with in-person or online education. Now, the state is confirming it has been inaccurate, but in a way that made local conditions seem worse than they really were. Reynolds spokesman Pat Garrett said that the state's data system has been erroneously recording the results of people who were tested on multiple occasions. He said that an individual's most recent result, whether positive or negative, was unintentionally attributed to the date of their first test. That means thousands of recent results were recorded in the system as having occurred in March, April, May, and June. The state updated the coronavirus dashboard Wednesday to fix the errors. Garrett said revisions reduced the current 14-day positivity rate in 80% of Iowa's 99 counties, while others saw an average increase of less than 1%. Garrett did not immediately say how many thousands of test results were impacted or release a county-by-county breakdown. But some changes were dramatic. Humboldt County had the state's highest positivity rate Tuesday of more than 22%, but it plummeted Wednesday to 8.9%. Webster County, which recently was among the state's highest, dropped to near the bottom with 2.6%. School districts have been using those rates to determine whether they must reopen for in-person instruction in the coming days or whether they can seek waivers to begin the year with online instruction only. Parents have been using the data to help inform their decisions about whether to send their kids back to school. The governor has ordered schools to return for at least 50% in-person instruction as long as the local positivity rate is below 15%, a threshold that is 3 times higher than many experts suggest is safe. But she has also said parents must have the choice to have their kids learn from home. The state's practice of erroneously backdating positive tests for someone who had previously tested negative became public in media reports this week. But it wasn't clear until Wednesday that new negative tests were also being backdated. In brief, Iowa officials say second person injured in boat crash has died. A second person has died from injuries received in an eastern Iowa boat crash on the Mississippi River, Iowa officials said Wednesday. Craig Verbecki, 61, of Moline, Illinois, died in a hospital Wednesday, 3 days after a boat he was aboard collided with a larger boat on the river near LeClaire, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources said in a news release. The crash also killed Dr. Anita Pink, 52, of Moline, Illinois, who was a Davenport obstetrician and gynecologist. Officials said she and Verbecki were aboard the same 19-foot Bayliner boat. A 36-year-old woman on the other boat, a 35-foot center console vessel, suffered minor injuries, officials said. The State Natural Resources Department continued Wednesday to ask that anyone who witnessed the crash to contact the department. South Dakota City mourns urban cornstalk's brief life. Residents of South Dakota's largest city are mourning an urban cornstalk that briefly became a lighthearted beacon of hope during the coronavirus pandemic. The Sioux Falls Argus Leader reported Wednesday that the stalk had been growing up through a crack in the concrete at the intersection of 57th Street and Minnesota Avenue on Sioux Falls' south side. Dubbed the 57th Street Corn, complete with its own Twitter account during its brief lifespan, the plant was a symbol of resiliency and hope as the pandemic rages on, Mayor Paul Tenhocken said. Finding joy in the small things will continue to help us get through what has been a challenging time in our country, the mayor said. It was amazing to see the community rally around the 57th Street Corn as a sign of hope over the past few days. Residents reported Wednesday morning that someone had ripped out the lone stalk, prompting an outcry on social media. Someone attached a sign to a traffic post where the stock grew that reads, Corn RIP. The Stockyards Ag Experience, a group working to transform the city's vacant stockyards into an interactive experience, is selling t-shirts commemorating the stock. Pharmacists can give childhood shots, U.S. officials say. Pharmacists in all 50 states are now allowed to give childhood vaccinations under a new directive aimed at preventing future outbreaks of measles and other preventable diseases. Alex Azar, the head of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, took the step using emergency powers he has during the U.S. coronavirus epidemic, which was declared a public health emergency. The directive announced Wednesday will temporarily preempt restrictions in 22 states starting this fall. The move is designed to help prevent vaccination rates from falling during the pandemic, Azar said. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has reported that orders for childhood vaccines from doctors' offices plummeted in late March and early April as their offices closed or saw fewer patients, raising concerns that vaccination rates would fall. But a survey of pediatricians in May suggested that most offices were open and able to give recommended shots, and more than half were able to take on new patients if needed. Another CDC report from late last month noted New York City saw a rebound in kids getting their shots. National 2020 numbers from the agency are not expected for another year. Especially as we approach the school season, it is critical that children have easy access to the pediatric vaccinations to enable them to get back to school as schools reopen, Azar said. The Trump administration has been pushing for schools and daycare centers to reopen as part of an effort to allow parents to return to work and help revive the economy. Currently, 28 states allow pharmacists to administer vaccinations to children, Azar said. In 22 states, laws limit such vaccinations, including 3 states that prohibit pharmacists from giving immunizations to any kids. The authorization allows state-licensed pharmacists to administer childhood vaccines without a doctor's prescription. Pharmacists must first complete a training program, although many already have, Azar said. The measure does not okay pharmacists to give shots to children younger than 3. Some of the most important childhood vaccinations are given to babies and toddlers, but pharmacists don't have the training or medical support to administer doses to young children, said Dr. Brett Garrar, the HHS Assistant Secretary for Health. Most childhood vaccinations are given at doctor's offices, and it's relatively unusual for kids to get vaccinations at pharmacies. In 2018, only about 7% of childhood flu shots were administered at pharmacies, according to CDC data, and it's even rarer for other childhood shots to be given at drugstores. Trump, U.S. demands restoration of U.N. sanctions against Iran. The United States will demand Thursday that all United Nations sanctions be reimposed against Iran, President Donald Trump announced Wednesday, a move that follows America's embarrassing failure to extend an arms embargo against Tehran. The administration's insistence on snapping back international sanctions against Iran sets the stage for a contentious dispute. It's possible that the U.S. call will be ignored by other U.N. members, an outcome that could call into question the U.N. Secretary Council's ability to enforce its own legally binding decisions. 2 years ago, I withdrew the United States from the disastrous Iran nuclear deal, which was a product of the Obama-Biden foreign policy failure, a failure like few people have seen in terms of the amount of money we paid for absolutely nothing and a short-term deal, Trump said. He pledged that under his administration, Iran will never have a nuclear weapon. If and when I win the election, within the first month, Iran will come to us and they are going to be asking for a deal so quickly because they are doing very poorly, he said, adding that sanctions have crippled Iran's economy and limited the amount of money it can use to support militant groups. North Korea to unveil new economic plans in January party meeting. North Korea will hold a rare ruling party congress in January where leader Kim Jong-un will announce a new 5-year plan to develop the country's dismal economy ravaged by U.S.-led sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic, state media said Thursday. The plans were confirmed Wednesday during a plenary meeting of the Workers' Party's Decision-Making Central Committee, where Kim acknowledged economic shortcomings caused by unexpected and inevitable challenges in various aspects and the situation in the region surrounding the Korean Peninsula. The report by Pyongyang's official Korean Central News Agency didn't directly mention nuclear diplomacy with the United States, which has stalled over disagreements in exchanging sanctions relief and denuclearization steps. Trump praises QAnon conspiracists, appreciates support. President Donald Trump on Wednesday praised the supporters of QAnon, a convoluted pro-Trump conspiracy theory, and suggested he appreciates their support of his candidacy. Speaking during a press conference at the White House, Trump courted the support of those who put stock in the conspiracy theory, saying, "I heard that these are people that love our country." It was Trump's first public comment on the subject and continued a pattern of a president appearing unwilling to resoundingly condemn extremists who support his candidacy. QAnon has ricocheted around the darker corners of the internet since late 2017, but has been creeping into mainstream politics more and more. The baseless theory centers on an alleged anonymous, high-ranking government official known as Q, who shares information about an anti-Trump deep state often tied to Satanism and child sex trafficking. Trump insisted he hadn't heard much about the movement other than "I understand they like me very much, and it is gaining in popularity." Trump has retweeted QAnon promoting accounts, and shirts and hats with QAnon symbols and slogans are not uncommon at his rallies. Reports: Michigan reaches $600 million deal in Flint water crisis. Michigan has reached a $600 million agreement to compensate Flint residents whose health was damaged by lead-tainted drinking water after the city heeded state regulators' advice not to treat it properly, multiple news outlets reported Wednesday. Details will be released later this week, according to reports by the Detroit News, MLive.com, and WXYZ-TV. The offices of Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Attorney General Dana Nessel have been negotiating for more than 18 months with attorneys for thousands of Flint residents who have filed lawsuits against the state. Ryan Jarvie, a spokesman for Nessel, declined to confirm the reports of a deal Wednesday night. "We and the other parties are bound by a federal court order to maintain the confidentiality of detailed settlement and mediation communications until we reach a certain point," Jarvie said. "We have not yet reached the point where we can discuss a potential settlement. The settlement is intended to resolve all legal actions against the state for its role in a disaster that made the impoverished, majority black city a nationwide symbol of governmental mismanagement. A state-appointed emergency manager was in charge in 2014 when Flint switched its water source from the city of Detroit to the Flint River to save money. State officials advised the city not to apply corrosion controls to the water, which was contaminated by lead from aging pipes." Snowing cocoa? Chocolate factory glitch dusts Swiss town. Residents of a Swiss town got a bit of a shock when it started snowing particles of a fine cocoa powder after the ventilation system at a chocolate factory malfunctioned. The Lindt and Sprungli company confirmed local reports Tuesday that there was a minor defect in the cooling ventilation for a line of roasted cocoa nibs in its factory in Olten between Zurich and Basel. The nibs, fragments of crushed cocoa beans, are the basis of chocolate. Combined with strong winds on Friday morning, the powder spread around the immediate vicinity of the factory, leaving a fine cocoa dusting. The company says one car was lightly coated and that it has offered to pay for any cleaning needed, but hasn't yet been taken up on the offer. Factory production was able to continue as normal, and the company says the particles were completely harmless to people or the environment. The ventilation system has now been repaired. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, August 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle. So it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.